I'm Vermont Edition co-host Bob Kinzel. Just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm. I don't think my butter odyssey is unique. I grew up with butter, and then for some inexplicable reason, I was on margarine. I can honestly say I have been margarine-free for the past 20 years as I re-embrace the beauty of butter. Today, we're going to learn about the history, the lore, and the art of butter making, and about some of the butter makers here in Vermont. One of those Vermont butter makers is Diane St. Clair of Animal Farm in Orwell. A few years ago, she shared the story of how her butter got recognized by one of the country's top chefs.
When I started making my product, I'm so small that I knew I wasn't going to make money based on volume. So I really had to develop a niche. And so I was reading a lot about restaurants and chefs, and I happened to pick up a book called The Soul of the Chef by Michael Ruhlman, which is a book that profiles two very well-known chefs, Michael Steinman from Cleveland and Thomas Keller, whose French Laundry had just been called the best restaurant in the United States by the New York Times. And when I was reading the section on Keller, he went on and on about how important butter was in cooking and how much he loved it. So when I finally got my license and was trying to find a market, I said to myself, you know, I have no idea if this is really good butter. I like it. So I said, I'm going to write Thomas Keller. And he emailed me back and said that, sure, you know, send some along. I put, I think, 6 pounds of it in a FedEx box, and I overnighted it to the French Laundry. The next day when I got home from picking my son up at school, there was a message on my machine from Thomas Keller, which was just, you know, my heart was racing. And he said, this is the best butter I've ever had. You have to call me back. Which, of course, I did. And he said, what are you doing? How do you make this? This is just amazing. And he said, look, I'll just buy whatever you can make. He didn't ask me how much money I wanted for it. He said, just make it and send it.
That's Diane St. Clair of Animal Farm in Orwell talking about her artisanal butter, which she still makes, but she's also now making perfumes and scents, believe it or not. We're going to discuss butter today, though, and we're going to do that with Elaine Kosarova. She's author of Butter, A Rich History. Elaine, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Isn't that a great story about butter?
Yeah, Diane's story is wonderful, and I did feature her in my book among other artisanal producers, especially because her story was so wonderful. This, you know, big city chef and this small farmer in Vermont, that it caught media headlines really around the country, and because of that, this whole notion of bringing back butter, you know, became more and more of a thing, more that people were considering. You know, people that had dairy farms were like, wow, a big chef wants, maybe wants some of my little batch of butter. You know, so little by little, she really helped sort of open people's eyes to the possibility of this reemergence of artisanal butter.
Well, how far back can we trace butter making?
Well, we'll never know exactly, because it's prehistoric. So we're talking at least 10, 12, possibly 15,000 years ago. And more than likely, butter making developed in various places independently. So it's not like it started in one place and then spread around the world. There were yak butter makers, you know, in the Mongolian region, and there was butter making in northern Africa, and the Sumerians were making butter. So it's been a product, you know, it's been in our lives with us for thousands and thousands of years.
What is the basic process of making butter?
Well, you typically take cream, although you can churn whole milk, and people have done that. People still do that, actually, in places like Bhutan and Nepal and in India. I visited those places to see how they make their butter with whole milk. But in this country, and generally in Western countries, we skim the cream off of the milk, and then that cream is usually ripened a little bit. It has to sit for a little while, because if you take really, truly fresh cream, it's actually harder to churn. So it ripens. Sometimes it's even cultured, which means that certain bacteria are added to it to help kind of give it a little tanginess, which is very popular in a place like, for instance, in France. But it's cultured butter is growing in this country, too. So once the cream has been undergone this little treatment and ripening, culturing, it's then put into a churn. And a churn is essentially anything that agitates it. I mean, I use a food processor at home. But you can use all kinds of things, including just a jar that you shake. But in this country, most small butter makers have a churn that looks, you know, it spins around like a washing machine in a way. And it's just this kind of cylinder that agitates the butter. The big guys, the industrial producers, have something called a continuous churn that's massive, and it does the same thing, but it does it super fast so that within 3 seconds they turn cream into butter.
Elaine, as we heard, Thomas Keller doesn't, but it seems like a lot of people take butter for granted. Why is that?
Yeah, it's so common. I mean, look at our store shelves, right? It's always there. It's reliably there. And that's a pretty modern thing. You know, for most of humankind's history, it's certainly in dairying, butter was a very seasonal product. You know, it was abundant in the spring and the summer when there was lots of lactating animals, and not just cows, sheep and goat and yak and water buffalo. So the milk was abundant in these warm seasons, and people had to do stuff with it. So, you know, they made butter, they made cheese to preserve basically that good nutrition. We're lucky because we have refrigeration and, you know, we have sanitation. We have all these systems now in place that allow us to make butter and keep butter, preserve butter. We can have it anytime we want. But that's really in the last 100 years.
What can people taste in really fine butters?
Well,
your answer said it all right there.
Yeah, exactly. Delicious. There are many wonderful butters out there. I think even the simplest ones are delicious if they're fresh. You know, that's the key, is that you don't want an old butter or a butter that's been stored improperly, because then you taste off flavors, things like rancidity. And there are, in fact, at least 20 different defects that a butter taster, a certified butter taster, you know, someone who works for the USDA, they will analyze butters for like 20 different flavor or texture defects. So there is quite a lot that can go wrong with butter. But for the most part, you know, we have wonderful butter. And what I taste in my favorite butters, I do like cultured butters, so I like a little bit of tang that complements that natural sweetness that's in a lot of lactic products. Obviously, the salt portion is something that changes dramatically from brand to brand. Mm-hmm. And then what I like to really analyze when I'm looking at butters, I often do butter tastings. And I'm fascinated by the textures of the butters and how they can change at room temperature, especially. If you take them all out of the fridge, they more or less seem the same. But if you let them sit out, you'll notice that some of them are kind of firm and waxy, and others can be a little bit greasy and loose. There's a wide variety of moisture content. I mean, by law, they can't have more than 20% moisture content, basically water in butter. But there's a wide range of between, you know, that 20% and, say, 18% water. So that sounds like little changes, but it has a huge effect on the mouthfeel of butter, the moisture content in a butter. And you don't want a butter that doesn't have some water in it. You know, people think, oh, yep, the more fat, the better. But it can actually taste a little dry on the palate if and more greasy if there isn't a little bit of water in the butter.
It does seem as if we are undergoing a revival in slow butters or better butters. Is that the case? And if so, why?
Yes, I definitely see that as I travel around the country, even around the world. You know, one of the things that prompted my book was I was working as an editor for a cheese magazine, so I traveled to many different dairy regions, And I was seeing more and more of these small batch butters at farmers markets, in little food boutiques, and really intrigued, again, by the nuances between them, because essentially butter is one ingredient if you disregard salt, because you don't have to add salt. And so, yes, I was seeing all these small batch butters around the country, especially in places like Wisconsin and Vermont, you know, dairy regions of our country. And I think it's partly to help the bottom line on some in some farms. There's certainly a return to homesteading and small farm operations, and these young farmers who have small, you know, these small plots of land, they have to really maximize everything they have. It kind of harkens back to, you know, 200 years ago when people had to make the most of everything. They didn't just take their milk and sell it off to the creamery. You know, they made as much as they could out of it. So we're seeing also, like, look at the ice cream market. That's expanding, too. It's the same kind of impulse that we have this rich dairy product. You know, what can we do with it and sell under our own brand?
Elaine, I'm now going to talk to someone who I first encountered her butter at a farmer's market. This is Marissa Morrow. She's the owner of Plowgate Creamery in Fayston. Marissa, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Rick and Elaine. Thanks for having me.
Hi, Marissa.
Marissa, tell us a little bit about your background in dairy.
Well, I got my start when I was 14 working on the Woodcock Farm in Weston and just fell in love with it. And from there, I kept working on smaller dairies that produce cheese.
Yeah, and you were a cheesemaker who went to butter making. Now, how did that happen?
Well, I had my cheese company in the Northeast Kingdom and had a fire there and took a few years off, and someone told me about the farm in Fayston, and when I came here, set foot on the property, it was perfect for a hilltop dairy. And the project started to evolve. I was looking for a new challenge, and I couldn't think of a cheese to make, although I've made a lot of cheese in my life. So I decided to focus on butter.
Well, in a Boston Globe piece, Kyle McClelland, who is the executive chef at Boston's Salty Girl, said, excuse me, about your butter, there's good butter out there, but there's nothing that really compares to yours. When you spread it on bread, it's like eating cheese. So what is it about your butter, Marissa, or the process you use that elicits a response like that?
Well, I think a lot of my product development came from my years in the cheesemaking industry. It's been now more than half my life I've been in dairy. But I also think it's our culture cocktail that we use and that our hands are in every part of the process.
Well, now retail, an 8-ounce package of your butter usually sells for around $8. And people can buy butter for a lot less. So how do you convince someone that yours is worth that much?
Well, first, I hope they taste it and that the taste really reveals its worth. But also all the hard work we put into it and who we collaborate with. We've been working with Monument Farms, buying their cream, which amazing, high butter fat, family-owned, been in business since the 30s. So there's a lot of people that work towards producing the product and a lot of hard work and love that go into it.
Are you still enjoying butter making?
I am. I'm actually making butter today. Just stepped up to talk to you.
Well, thanks for taking a few moments. Marissa Morrow is owner of Plowgate Creamery in Fayston. Take care, Marissa.
Take care.
You know, Rick, I just wanted to mention, too, that part of the upsurge, I think, in artisanal small batch butter making is changing attitudes about fat. You know, we now feel that fat is getting a reprieve finally from all the, you know, the demonizing that happened over the last 50 years. And butter was probably suffered the most. I mean, butter and its saturated fat suffered a lot. But now we're coming to understand how complex fat is in the diet, how we need fat, how we need good fats. And so I think that's part of why you're seeing a real market for these butters.
We did hear from Ray Elaine. He wrote, "My mother puts butter on almost everything. We joke that if she stopped eating it, she would probably just disappear." I have wondered if this has to do with when butter was its own food group during World War II. Is that the case? Was it its own food group then, or how was it classified?
Well, there was actually quite a shortage of butter during World War II because a lot of it, most of it, went to the troops. And so that's when you started to see margarine really take hold. So World War II was not good for butter. It was good for margarine companies.
Well, what are some of the butters you're enjoying?
Oh, goodness. Well, first of all, I do eat butter every day, you know, in moderation. Mm-hmm. And I know that in an organic grass-fed butter, I'm getting more nutrition. I'm getting more fat-soluble vitamins. I'm getting better fats. So I do generally choose organic Valley cultured butter as my go-to. Also, I live in a tiny town. I don't have a lot of choice. And there's not actually a butter maker right near me who's making butter. So that's sort of my go-to every day because I think those little micronutrients really add up. But I'll often splurge on Marissa's butter, for instance. I can drive half an hour and get her butter in Hudson, New York. It's terrific. I do love some of the AOC French butters. So an AOC butter means that it's made in the traditional way that it was originally made. So it doesn't have an industrial process. So every step of the journey from the cow to the churn is kind of mandated for an AOC butter. The cows have to eat certain things. The cream has to be ripened or cultured in a certain way. The churning process, the draining, the buttermilk, all these things are very much protected in France in certain regions. So it's a real thing how good their butter is. It's not just reputation. There's a reason they have that reputation. Yeah. It's such good butter. But it's hard to come by increasingly because Chinese people now want butter. And they're willing to pay more for it. So I'm finding that in the U.S., it's getting harder to get those precious butters. And I think that's why. Maybe someone out there knows for sure, but that's what I've been reading, is that the Chinese people are starting to take some of the good butters because they obviously don't have much of an industry in China yet.
A few other Vermont butter makers we should mention. There's Cabot Creamery. Kimblebrook Farm makes an organic butter, and also Jersey Girls in Chester. And you're not going to believe this, Elaine, but just before I went on the air, honest to goodness, breaking butter news. This came over the wire. Allison Hooper, co-founder of Vermont Creamery, has been named to the James Beard Foundation's Who's Who of Food and Beverage in America for 2018. So
that's great. She deserves that. Yeah. Absolutely.
We did hear from Bruce from Essex, who wrote, "In March 1931, the Vermont legislature was a hotbed of debate over legislation to prohibit the sale of yellow margarine in Vermont. Vermont State Senator Murdoch, who opposed the ban, charged, quote, 'There is more injustice and tyranny in this bill than exercised by Soviet Russia.' His attempt to derail the bill failed 20-10, and the debate was a front page story in the Burlington Free Press." And let's take a call from Rafe, who's calling us from Montreal. Rafe, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have two questions. Mm-hmm. The first is, if butter is labeled organic, does that imply that it's grass-fed? And the second is freezing. If I freeze butter, it's like I don't use that much of it. Does that change the ability to the taste or how it cooks?
Elaine, can you answer either of those?
Sure. I'll just answer first about the freezing butter. So an expert in the dairy world would say, yes, it changes the crystalline structure of butter if you freeze it. And that's true, you know, but scientific level, I would say. In your kitchen, it's not going to really behave any differently. I freeze butter all the time. I know that even in the industry, they freeze butter because there's so much of it in the spring and the summer, but then they reprocess it before they sell it again just so the crystalline structure is the same, because we really they're really proud of this, the cohesive structure of butter and in the industry, so it's really protected. But I would say for the average person, go ahead and freeze it.
Now, the second question was about organic. Does that imply grass-fed?
It's no guarantee. The organic cows, you know, they can't be given antibiotics, and their feed has to be natural, and they generally are treated better, but there's no guarantee that they're on grass, that they're out in the fields, that they're in pasture, or even if they're inside, if they're getting grass, they could be getting quite a bit of grain. So you really have to do some homework. Most butters do label now that they're grass-fed, but I've found, for instance, Finlandia, they have a system of feeding cows grass year-round, and it's not something they promote very much. I think they're just starting to now. So you have to do a little homework. But grass-fed really, it's hard to know for sure unless you know the farm. When you're talking to a local producer, I'm not talking about the big guys who have branding, but you have to talk to your farmer or your butter maker to find out if they're if they have their cows on grass.
Where did research for your book take you?
Oh, around the world. I went to Bhutan because I specifically wanted to see yak butter making as it has been done for thousands of years. Literally, it has not changed. The only thing that's changed is the people wear synthetic clothing. But I hiked up to the very top of these mountains where yak herders live and watched their process of dairying and collecting the milk and churning it into yak butter. I also went to India for the same reason, to see water buffalo butter making. Again, this is a very ancient practice. People have been making water buffalo butter for a very long time. And in that country, they take the milk and they turn it into a yogurt, essentially, and churn the yogurt. It was delicious. It was actually one of the best butters I tasted in my tour. And, of course, I went to France. I went to Ireland. I went to quite a few states in this country, dairy states. And England too. It was most of the butter making regions around the world. And I would have loved to have gone to North Africa because they have even more unusual traditions about burying butter and combining it with spices while they're churning it, they add spices to it. But I ran out of money.
Oh, my. Well, let's talk to Lisa McCrory now. She's co-owner of Earthwise Farm and Forest in Bethel, where they teach cheese, butter, and yogurt making. Lisa, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for being there.
Lisa, how did you learn butter making?
I found a few books as I was we've got a couple milk cows, and we're certified organic, and I wanted to use all the milk that we were producing for our own use. And so I started looking into different books. I think I found some stuff from Ricky Carroll. She's got some books on cheese making and includes yogurt and butter. And then I found another book on dairy foods cookbook and little things like that that just had some basic instructions on making butter. So I took it from there, and I've been experimenting and improving my butter ever since.
So you teach this class. What is the goal of the class that you teach on butter making?
Well, we sell raw milk off our farm, and we're members of rural Vermont. We're at a time about 8 years ago, there was a large push to make sure that we could continue to do this legally. So by doing these raw milk dairy workshops, we were introducing people to raw milk and all its benefits, but also like, okay, you've bought this milk, what can you do with it? So it encouraged people to get a little more creative in the kitchen and have some confidence. And as those classes have just been really popular on our farm because we're a small homestead farm. People want to learn more about self-sufficiency. And so continuing from this launch of these butter cheese yogurt classes that I did with Rural Vermont, I've continued to do it for the past 8 or 9 years now, offering it about, 10 or 12 times a year as there is demand. So it's just been a lot of fun, and more people, the people that are coming to these classes are people that are buying milk or producing one or two cows on a home scale and just wanting to refine their skills. You know, you can get it from a book, but the hands-on experience with a group of people is really fun. And then I can share all the, you know, don't do, you know, I can save people a lot of time. You know, you don't have to make this mistake because I can show you, I can give you some encouragement. Let's try it this way and you're going to be much more successful.
And is the class just for making butter with raw milk?
What we cover, I will help people find out, well, if you don't have access to raw milk, you can buy cream in the store. And, you know, these are the varieties that you can do it successfully with, like, you know, ultra high temperature pasteurized milk oftentimes is very hard to make value-added products with. But if you find lower temperature pasteurization products in the store, you can also be successful with making the products that we'd be doing in the class that I teach.
And when are the classes that are coming up?
Well, this Thursday, I have a class on butter, yogurt, and cheese making from 12 to 3:30 at our farm. And then I'll be doing the same class on the 15th of July, and it'll be on a Sunday. So the class is about 3.5 hours long, and we dive right into it, and you get to eat everything you're making, and people take home little samples of butter that they made, and I guarantee if they don't get all eaten up during the class, they'll be finished by the end of the day when they take it home. It's just delicious.
Lisa McCrory is co-owner of Earthwise Farm and Forest in Bethel. They have this cheese, butter, and yogurt making class this week and in the future, and you can find a link at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. Lisa, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Let's take another call from Joe. He's calling from Bridport. Joe, thanks for calling Vermont Edition.
Hi. I wanted to talk about my experiences in the 40s, well, from the World War II time through the part of the early 60s, let's say, on the family farm down in Connecticut, Old Saybrook, Connecticut, on the shoreline. We had the original genetics of the Guernseys came over from Guernsey, which is a totally different animal than the what they've turned them into. The butter, or the, let's say the milk, was so rich, the cream was amazing. You could stand a spoon up in it when it was chilled; it wouldn't fall over for an hour. The excess cream or excess milk we had, we skimmed for the cream, and we would sit in a circle, the family, and pass the churn around. When somebody got tired of cranking, the next one would take over, and that's how we made our butter, and it was delicious.
Oh, that sounds amazing. Great.
I bet. Yeah.
Thanks,
that
Joe.
Sounds wonderful.
Well, he mentions Guernseys. Yeah. So, Elaine, how do the different breeds of cows, you know, affect the butter that is made from that milk?
Well, many things affect the cream. So it's the breed, but also within the breed, the health of the animal, the age of the animal, the part of the lactation cycle that the animal is in. So many, many things affect the fat content, the fat composition. You know, when professional butter makers, industrial butter makers are making their butter, they're very careful to balance the ratio of liquid and crystalline fats within the cream, and they do this by a process of tempering. And this is because they're trying to simulate really the best kind of cream that you can have to make butter, the best chemical composition of the cream. And so some cows give a much better cream composition than others. The Guernseys are famous for the cream. I mean, there was a butter maker in Vermont, Mountain Home, that is in my book, and I love their butter, and it came from Guernsey cows, which I think they're not in operation at the moment.
Right.
But that was an exceptional butter, and it's a shame we don't have more of those cows in this country. Mostly we've gone to Holsteins because they produce the most milk. But their cream is, you know, it needs a little tempering to be the right composition for producing butter. A lot of butter makers and cheese makers like the cream from Jersey cows, which is also pretty exceptional. So there, when I was traveling, there were so many different breeds. And I think that, you know, I'm sure that accounted for the many different flavors that I've encountered in the butter world.
Well, we did get this from Maria from Cate Hill Orchard and Sheep Dairy in Greensboro. She says, I make cultured sheep butter for my family, and it's amazing. Mm. It's pure white and may have an even higher fat content than cow's butter. Can you talk about sheep butter? Here it's practically unheard of. Is it made in other parts of the world?
Yes, sheep butter was actually, sheep and goat butter were among the very, you know, first butters in the world because sheep and goat were very easy to, relatively easy to domesticate compared to other bigger animals. So cow's butter came along much later, but sheep butter and goat butter used to be very common throughout the world. And even during the Roman Empire, because the Romans had, the Romans themselves didn't really like butter, but in the northern parts of the world where they ruled, they had a lot of sheep because they could get wool and meat and cheese for their armies. But then the leftover from cheese making, they would have a sort of buttermilk that they could use to make butter with. So it's really disappeared for the most part from the butter scene, except for small, tiny producers. There is a sheep butter producer in California. Gosh, the name escapes me now. It's in my book.
Yep.
But she makes a wonderful, like you said, a cultured sheep's milk butter that is absolutely delicious. I have had some that are a little bit greasy. It can have a little greasy taste, but I think when you use really fresh milk, that doesn't happen. That was explained to me. I've served it at butter tastings when I can get my hands on it, and people really do like it. You have to get past the white color because it looks a little bit like lard, but it's really delicious. I love it. And I like to mix my butters too, like my goat butter and my cow butter and my sheep butter.
Oh,
I like to mix things up.
Yeah. We're almost out of time. I want to get to another topic that you mentioned in the book that's really interesting. Women have had a substantive role in butter making throughout history. So why is that?
Hmm. Women founded the dairy world, the dairy industry. It was founded by women. And I found in my research that almost universally it was taboo, going back, you know, thousands of years, it was taboo for men to have anything to do with dairying because it was so closely associated with birthing and lactation, fertility. It was very much a female domain. And so women were in charge of the cows and the milking and processing the milk. And this continued, you know, for many, many thousands of years. It really all changed in the late 1800s. But in parts of the world that I visited, like Bhutan and in India, on the small farms, women still were in charge of all the dairy products. So it really goes back to, you know, really women, it would, you know, women really grew this whole industry, and then it changed. It was sort of taken away from them in the late 1800s with industrialization.
And I hate to throw a big one at you like this as we're running out of time, but butter and margarine, you know, what happened where butter went out of vogue and margarine came into vogue?
Oh, boy, there's a whole chapter in my book about that.
Mm-hmm.
So margarine came on the scene in the late 1800s. And partly it was, first of all, that butter, the original, that margarine, the original margarine was made with beef fat and a little bit of milk and salt and a little natural food coloring. So it was actually nothing like the margarines that we're familiar with, which are made with vegetable oils. But that early margarine was made to offer something else to people that couldn't afford good butter. There was a lot of bad butter on the market, you know, way back in the day. And this, you know, this continued throughout history because before there was refrigeration and sanitation, a lot of the butter would go off. It was very hard to keep butter. It was heavily, heavily salted so that it wouldn't spoil. So there was something called renovated butter, which was a really nasty product, but produced by the ton in this country in the 1800s, and when Elaine, margarine came along.
Elaine, I'm going to have to ask everyone to read your book to learn more about the margarine invasion.
Yeah.
Elaine Kosrova is the author of Butter, A Rich History. I want to thank you so much for talking about butter with us today. You know everything about butter.
I know too much. Yeah.
All right. Take care.
Okay. Bye.
And coming up from the delightful subject of butter, we're going to talk about something that's more concerning. We're going to talk about the subject of shingles and what's being done to help you avoid it. This is Vermont Edition on VPR.